Take a network break. Hey, I'm back from vacation, and Greg, I heard you serve virtual baklava last week.
The virtual donuts, they've been a little bit fattening, and I thought we might just have a change. I mean, really, you can't have too many virtual donuts, to be fair. But I was also had a hankering for some virtual chai. And so last week I was drinking chai tea with my virtual baklava.
That sounds pretty good. I hope you save some for me.
it's on its way to you now. I shipped you a bucket load. So
you'll be
getting some via the internet very soon, you know.
Woohoo!
But I just thought we'd change it up with the virtual baklava, because if you're not here, who's bringing the virtual donuts?
That's a good point. And it's nice to change it up every now and then. So yeah,
I think so. Well done.
All right, we got a little business and then we got a ton of news to talk about. So let's talk about today's sponsor, Thousand Eyes. They give you performance visibility from every user to every app over any network, both internal and external, so you can migrate to the cloud, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experience. Sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free Thousand Eyes t-shirt. And stay tuned after the news. We're going to have a Tech Bytes conversation with Big Switch Networks. They've got some new offerings for hybrid and multi-cloud networking, including a controller to manage AWS VPCs. We're going to talk about that in the news section a little bit, and also as a Tech Byte, so stay tuned. All right, let's start with some FU, Greg.
Got an email from Anonymous again. There's a lot of people calling themselves Anonymous lately, which is fine because that's how we like it when people send us follow-up, because then we don't mention names and get people into trouble, which is the main thing. We're not here to get people into trouble. We're here to try and cover the issues. Anonymous says, you mentioned that spam calls from overseas routes via their local carriers. He's highlighting that in Australia, a lot of overseas companies route via VoIP networks like Symbio, who then route into Australia via Primus and others. And those companies are certainly not going to cut off their customers from whom they earn a lot of money. So what he's referring to there is this SIP, the session initiation protocol, that trunks VoIP all around the world. Many companies these days just move it over the internet. That's exactly what I was pointing out, was a lot of these call centers are in Indonesia or India or in, and they just ring using free international phone calls. It doesn't cost them anything until they land in the US. And my point was that that's where the global response is needed. If you're going to stop them dialing into the country, how are you going to detect that? And at this point in time, people are spoofing the in-dial number, the direct in-dial number. They're spoofing the source. They're taking various techniques to spoof what's happening. And various governments around the world are winding up methods to do spam telephone calls. There's an article this week we didn't put in here because it's not really relevant to the network break, where 51 states have ganged up to try and work with the FCC to block spam phone calls and robocallers. But it's not going to be much good if you just do it inside one country. It's a global problem. You're quite right. Overseas international companies or callers doing VoIP over the internet are all responsible for it, and they make money out of it. And so you've got it's a government thing to fix this.
Yes. So fighting phone spam is going to require some international cooperation is the point.
I think email spam has set the path, though. Fortunately, the principle of filtering for the good of the people has been well established in spam, email spam.
So, yes. For the good of the people, to the ramparts. Some VMware news today. Just after snapping up Pivotal, VMware has written checks for two new acquisitions, including the endpoint security company Carbon Black for $2.1 billion and the telco-focused startup Uhana for an undisclosed amount.
Not often you see VMware spitting up about $4 billion worth of money. And that's real money. And we talked a lot about the Pivotal acquisition last week, and I sort of highlighted that it makes sense for VMware because a number of VMware customers bought Pivotal because Pivotal was part of EMC and VMware and so on and so forth. And so it makes sense to spin it in. But my other point was that I think Pivotal might have reached its limit, as it's got this way of working where it goes and forces people into a particular mode. And I think that fashion of telling people how to do things is falling out of fashion as DevOps and this, you know, many build chains, microservices sort of breaks down the value prop that Pivotal had, because Pivotal is a very top-down sell. More importantly, VMware gets a whole bunch of people who are out there in key accounts, salespeople pretty much, who have relationships, and they can bring Pivotal in and start using that to sell VMware, NSX, multi-cloud, hybrid cloud, VMware on AWS, and pivot the Pivotal customers into the VMware SDDC platform, I think. Yeah. So that makes sense from that point of view.
Yes. So let's move on to Carbon Black. This is, they call it cloud native endpoint protection. So it's endpoint protection, antivirus, and watching processes in a browser and the OS to see if there's anything suspicious, any alerting or blocking on that. I think an interesting acquisition for VMware.
Well, in the sense that I think there's a couple of different things coming on here. First of all, VMware is returning to the security market. This is previous attempts in 2013 or so, and in 2009 did not go well. And several billion dollars of money was blown up in a bonfire of the vanities sort of thing. So there's no guarantee here that what VMware is doing will be successful. But in the game of big companies keep trying and doing the same things all the time until one of them works, we'll see how this one goes. I think the point about endpoint protection is, remember we were talking 2 weeks ago about campus networking and how solving campus networking isn't really solving the problem about what happens when they're not on the campus. Mm-hmm. Or not on your Wi-Fi. What happens when people are on the 5Gs or the 4Gs or the 3Gs or they're at home on Wi-Fi? And this is where endpoint protection comes in, is if VMware can buy an endpoint protection system today, add it in, and then bond it with NSX, so then you get your micro-segmentation and your security, and you get the control and the network visibility and a unified orchestration of it, well, now you're suddenly, the whole campus networking thing becomes moot. Do you really care whether they're connected to the campus or not? You don't need to authenticate them on the campus switch or on the campus Wi-Fi. You just put the endpoint on and then you're away. So I see this as a cloud ready. So people are out there connected to the public WAN. They're going to connect to the cloud, VMware on AWS, and they're going to connect to the private stuff as well. This endpoint is a step down a path of saying we don't actually care about the network underneath physically or the access method. We've got a solution anywhere, anyhow, anywhere.
Yeah, the cloud part is that the you have to have an endpoint agent on the device, whether it's a server, a Windows box, a Linux box, or an end user computer. But what it's doing is that endpoint device then connects to the cloud to get updates and to send information about what's happening in the operating system for the cloud system to do its analysis and say, hey, this looks suspicious.
And that's pretty normal. There's a whole bunch of companies, about a half a dozen of them in this space, that do more or less the same thing. Yeah. Carbon Black's one of the larger ones. We've seen VMware stepping outside the data center with the VeloCloud acquisition, with mm-hmm. the RV Networks acquisition, with the the AppNetter acquisition. They're getting into the analytics space. The logical thing is to get out to the end point. So into the handset, into the laptop, into the, you know, the desktop. And the endpoint technology does that. The quote here from Pat Gelsinger in the presentation to shareholders, they also announced their numbers today. We're not going to talk about that because it's not very interesting. They did just fine, you know, whatever. Just listen to this and then I'll make a comment. Yet, as I have said before, the current cyber industry is simply broken and ineffective with a plethora of fragmented tools, bloatware agents, and no cohesive platform architecture. But today we are taking a huge step forward in security by bringing Carbon Black into the VMware family to deliver an enterprise-grade platform to protect workloads, applications, and networks from device to cloud. So what he's saying there is we're going to take all the security industry and we're going to provide a unified platform. So we're going to stitch it all together. So that means a new business unit. And sure enough, in an interview, Pat Gelsinger said, Carbon Black CEO Patrick Morley will run a security business that VMware is forming, and VMware will move some existing assets into it. So VMware is effectively spinning up a whole business unit around security, and that's why it's spending so much money. When you spend the big money, you're normally starting up a whole business unit. You're not just buying a piece of this and a piece of that to buff up your existing product line or to add a feature to your product. You're actually starting up a whole business unit. So I think VMware is making a play here, again, to become a security business as well.
And extending its footprint. So it's been in the data center. Now it's in the cloud. The VeloCloud acquisition put it on the WAN. Now it gets to extend that footprint out to the endpoint. Mm. The second thing is they can tell a story about security almost everywhere. So NSX, micro-segmentation and firewalling in the data center, VeloCloud having some security capabilities in SD-WAN now on the endpoint, and also on, you know, your virtual machines and servers in the cloud. VMware already has App Defense, which puts some security controls in the hypervisor to monitor an application's behavior and look for tricky issues. They now say they've actually had a partnership with Carbon Black even before this acquisition called CB Defense for VMware, which you have App Defense in the hypervisor and then Carbon Black looking at the OS. And that's supposed to be sort of your 1-2 punch for protecting those virtual workloads.
And so most likely App Defense will form the basis of a non-agent driven endpoint protection system, if that makes sense. So you can imagine Carbon Black is managing smartphones and desktops and so forth, but it's also managing using its hypervisor to manage server endpoints, but agentless.
That I'm not sure about that. Yeah. And frankly, looking at Carbon Black's website, it's very hard to find details about how the product actually works.
No, there's an awful lot of bloviation about artificial intelligence. It's not. It doesn't look like artificial. It looks more like machine learning to me, but or maybe some deep learning at best. But I think this makes sense. VMware is having enormous amounts of success. It's making wads of money. the other companies that are, like Cisco, they're both sitting on substantial amounts of cash, and they can either give it back to shareholders or they can spend it on acquisitions and say, we're going to grow the business or make things more profitable, whatever. And so VMware has obviously decided that this is the way to go. I guess this also, the other part of the acquisition announcements was they're buying a company called Yuhana.
Yes.
Now this is they claim they're an AI. I see this as a machine learning play. I think the AI is a marketing thing, but it looks like this is a telco play.
It is a telco play. It's a startup founded in 2016 in Stanford. Apparently, they have a stream processing engine, so they ingest telemetry from telco and service provider systems. They say they do the radio access network, the core network, and even over-the-top applications. And the idea is that they give you visibility down to per-subscriber use applications, and the idea is looking where you can automate the network and also enhance the quality of the user experience.
Yeah, sounds a lot like other companies in this space like Kentek, who we've talked about on the show, and they recently announced their AI ops platform. So what they're doing is using deep learning and machine learning to take all of the flow records from your network and then tell you, you know, how well is your backbone performing? What is the customer experience across that? You know, is there a weak point in your network? Because up till now, telcos just waited until people complained, and then they went and researched and went, oh, look, that circuit's overloaded. Or there's a problem with that network. It's dropping 50% of the packets. Maybe we should do something about that. So I imagine that this is in that space based on, you know, they call it ingesting telemetry. I'd say it's just ingesting data and then using pretty typical deep learning, machine learning to try and extract some insights from the messages, from the logs.
Telemetry sounds better. Sounds cool.
AI-driven telemetry analysis sounds far more convincing than building a data lake and running an ML algorithm across it, correlating the logs to find something.
You've got to take the fun out of everything.
We've spoken to companies like Kentek and Deepfield. Deepfield's now part of Nokia. They all use the same language when they started out too.
Yeah, so I went over to Yuhana's website to check it out. It is sparse, just a few pages, not a lot of details, but I did find a link to an article that Light Reading wrote about them, about a trial they were doing with a telco in Hungary. So if you're looking for a little bit more color on what they're up to, we'll have a link to that in the show notes. VMware didn't say how much they spent on Yuhana, and given that it's a very young startup, I'm guessing it was couch change.
Not significant. But the message here is that the trend for visibility and analytics, and we've seen all sorts of companies get acquired or started, or, you know, all of the big companies are moving into this visibility and analytics, and that trend is continuing. This is another point on that road, that this is the big thing that you should be looking at for your networking, is visibility and analytics to prove that what you're doing is actually worth doing.
Yeah.
But they're not the only one. This isn't an innovation per se, that they're following the market here. Buying Carbon Black and putting Carbon Black onto their platform is much more structurally a change. That's building a security unit. And they're not talking about just, we've got a product. They're talking about building a security platform. So the language is very clear. You know, they see it as complementary to their existing products of App Defense, Workplace One, NSX, and Secure State. But, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens to things like their Horizon product, thin client stuff. Do you want to put endpoints in there as well? So there's all sorts of tensions going on as these companies get bigger and bigger. There'll be a bloodbath going in there. But
all right, let's move on. Big Switch dropped a fairly significant announcement. They're doing a lot around hybrid and multi-cloud networking. We're going to talk a little bit about it in our we'll talk in detail about it in our Tech Byte at the end of the show. But Greg, you wanted to just cover the announcement briefly.
Yeah, this is news. There's four things that are announcing, so I'll whip across them very quickly. But stay on for the Tech Byte if you'd like to hear more information about them, and I encourage you to do so. Now, the Big Switch's product now is based on the principle that if you've got this virtual private cloud networking feature like what AWS uses, then why don't, and you're going to go to the cloud over time, or if that model is the way we're all going to go, and I believe it is, the idea of a virtual private network that sits over the top, whether it's an EVPN using VXLAN or whether you're using MPLS or whether you're using SD-WAN, some sort of overlay protocol like, you know, TLS or IPsec, right? That's a proven model. And what we actually need to do is take that abstraction further and say, I just want these group of hosts to be in this microsegment. And that's where we're happening. So the way Big Switch has said, well, if virtual private, if VPCs like you see on AWS is where we're all going to end up, why don't we bring that into your data center, into your private cloud? So what Big Switch has now done is done four things. They've announced Big Cloud Fabric for AWS, which is a Big Cloud Fabric SDN controller. You put it on AWS and use it to manage your AWS network. So conceptually, you've now got a controller in AWS and a controller in your private data center, and you can now stitch the two together. So you get global VPCs.
Right? Yes.
So you have on-prem Big Cloud Fabric and off-prem, and then you can stitch them together using a multi-cloud director so that you've got one unified way of approaching their network. Now, the unique thing about this that I haven't seen other people do is they're not using agents, they're not using virtual switches, they're not putting routers in the cloud, they're not forcing you to put some sort of something into the BPF of the hypervisor or the container. This is just using the native networking features of the cloud that you're in. So today it's AWS, Azure and GCP will be, you know, down the pipeline.
And as customers demand, yeah.
Yes. Now, I think that's important because a lot of these other solutions burn a lot of cash putting in these very fat agents to act as nodes in their SDN. And that's fine. It's certainly a viable solution and it works and it's a good way of doing it because you get a lot of control and you get extra features. But you also incur some cost and complexity mm-hmm. with doing that. Whereas this approach, which is just to use the native part of the cloud, I think is a very viable one. And the idea of having a virtual private, a VPC or a virtual private cloud networking feature unified between your data center and the cloud is something that for people that, well, the thing that I instantly thought of is if you're somebody who believes that this is the way it's going, you want to get AWS skills. So you want to go out there. You want to be working in AWS and not just an overlay on AWS. You want to work in a native AWS so you can put on your resume AWS skills. I thought that was pretty neat. And the second thing I thought about is this is a much simpler version of ACI and NSX. ACI and NSX come with a lot of baggage. By the time you put those platforms into your data center, you've got a whole lot of stuff. You've got controllers and engines and rules and, you know, you've headcount and training and deployment and blah, blah, blah.
And some cases you need new hardware.
Yeah, it's a bit like taking a cruise liner for a two-hour booze cruise on the river. You're just overdoing it. You don't need Big Cloud, I think, is really simplifying down to just the functionality that a lot of people need. In the same way that, you know, the simpler you can make your products, then the easier they are to use and to consume. So I think that's where it is. But listen up for the Tech Bite and see if you can pull those messages out when we have the interview with Prashant Gandhi.
At the end of the show. All right, moving on. Google has quietly discontinued sharing Android performance data with mobile operators. This is according to a story in Reuters. The free service was called Mobile Network Insights, and its intent was to help carriers identify weak spots in their coverage. Reuters said Google shut down the service because of data privacy concerns.
So it made really good sense. Google's got all of these Android handsets out there, and if there's weak signals, they would give the information to the telco so that they would know that they need to put a base station up in this area. And in theory, users would get better networks because the carriers would know that there is poor coverage for their handsets. And in theory, Androids would get used more often and more dollar revenue for Google too, right? So,
right.
In theory, a win-win, or more correctly, a lose-lose for us. Because what those people were doing, what those telcos were doing, is effectively getting a lot of information about users. And I think that Google's realized that just giving away data to other people is exactly the same as what Facebook did with Cambridge Analytica. So walking away from this in this new environment where people are hypersensitive to privacy is a good move. I think thoughts struck me about this. People make a difference. The more we complain about privacy, if you care about it, then the more that this gets noticed. And I don't think that Google could have done anything less. They couldn't have made a smaller effort to become privacy focused.
Oh, no. Definitely. Not at all. I've got a couple of perspectives here. One, so the service used location history and diagnostics data. It was only from users who had opted to share that information with Google. Now, Google didn't necessarily inform those users that Google would be sharing that with third parties. So I think that's probably where they felt like they may be running into some potential trouble. Oh. And sure, that's an issue. But the other thing is, like, of all the ways that data is being collected about us, this was actually a useful use of that data that could actually benefit in better service. And so for all of the ways to Google to suddenly be worried about privacy, this seems like them saying it's not about them being worried about user privacy. It's them worried about being caught up in a Facebook/Cambridge Analytica scandal because the issue is that third party sharing.
In particular, they're frightened of the US government.
I actually think they're frightened of GDPR more than the U.S. government, because the U.S. government, the U.S. government is making noise, but they don't have any regulations in place like GDPR does. So we've got another story about Google. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about how the government in Kazakhstan was testing digital certificates that would allow it to intercept and decrypt web browser traffic, and that it was compelling citizens to install this cert. Now, Google, Mozilla, and Apple are saying that they are going to block this government cert in Chrome, Firefox, and Safari browsers.
So this is actually a gathering of what I call the Republic of Certificate Authorities. So the people who make the web browsers effectively have representatives who go to various meetings. I did some digging into the behind the scenes on this, And it was basically agreed amongst all the people who run the certificate authorities inside of the browsers that the root certificate that Kazakhstan wanted to bury in these browsers would be blocked by them. Mm-hmm. So that even if they wanted to, so, you know, last week or the week before we talked about how they tried it and now they've walked back from it. I suspect that they knew that this was coming.
And, yeah, the Kazakh government said it was just a test. It's over now.
So there is a question here that you could ask, you know, is it right for Google to make this decision? Well, Google didn't. It was Google, Mozilla, and Apple together. So this is what I mean. There is a consensus as a republic idea. That is, our nominated representatives act on our behalf. It's not, at least it's not royalist or feudalist. You know, we don't have a king of CAs to make those, like we do with Cloudflare, you know, like the king of Cloudflare making decisions to who's on his network or not. Mm. At least there's some consensus building from opposing forces about the right way forward. So I think this is a good thing. However, it is still questionable. I still believe that governments should have sovereign power in their own countries. Rightly or wrongly, you do have to respect that the governments, you know, if you want to force your opinions on other people, there's a very thin line there when you want to be careful about what you're saying.
One thing, you know, Google can crow about this, and I think they need to crow about this because they've had some very bad publicity around their willingness to potentially cooperate with repressive governments like the so-called Project Dragonfly, which is supposed to create a censorship-friendly browser for China. It aligns, I think, more with Apple and Mozilla, who are staking their businesses around being privacy forward and privacy centric and protecting consumers. So that's sort of in line with them. The one question I have is, would these three organizations do the same thing if, say, China wanted to put forth its own certificate that it was going to enforce on their users? That's a much bigger market than Kazakhstan, much more influence, and much more money for them to lose if they decide to thwart the Chinese government. So,
yeah, this is the difference between a republic, you know, a consensus of people in, mm-hmm. in authority, and a king. Sometimes yep. Google can act like a king and do whatever the hell it likes and damn what the people think. And yep. And other times when it needs to build a consensus, we tend to have more balanced points of view, I think.
I'm curious about when it comes down to where the real money is, how their attitudes may or may not change.
Well, speaking of that, there's also a series of articles this week about anti-eye tracking in web browsers. It turns out that WebKit and Mozilla have both announced that they are actively going to be blocking known tracking methods of user privacy. Now, this is, mm-hmm. I see this as really quite something. And if you read the policies, and there's links in the show notes to the privacy policies that WebKit and Mozilla are talking about. Well, WebKit and Mozilla, of course, is Safari, which is Apple's browser. That's the open source project behind Safari that does the browser rendering. And then mm-hmm. Mozilla is Firefox. And yep. those two organizations are very customer focused. That is, the customer of them is their person using the browser. And both right. of those organizations believe that committing to privacy is good for their product.
Yes.
Google Chrome is noticeable by its absence. It's not committing to privacy. But the point here is that the customer for Google Chrome is not you and I, it's Google. And right. Google uses its dominance of Google Chrome to improve user surveillance and data harvesting and to protect their advertising revenues. Witness what they did with ad blockers. They got the ad blockers to come on board and basically paid them off to keep whitelists of good ads.
Right.
Fairly
right.
dodgy, and I believe sort of not really moral at all.
Right? It's not really an ad blocker.
Yeah. And Google's also using Chrome to promote technologies like AMP and DNS over HTTPS that move the internet in directions that suits their own purposes. Now, sometimes users also benefit by improving security or improving speed. But at the same time, Chrome is also lining Google's pockets with the same thing. So I think this move by WebKit and Firefox is very good. They're very focused on users, and that includes companies. Companies need to be very concerned, in my opinion, about whether people are tracking their employees around the web to see what they're doing. And mm-hmm. if you could track your employees, say if I could track your purchasing department as they move around the web, I would be able to get competitive information about what's happening inside your business. And indeed, when I go for a search, I did find some very interesting companies that are doing exactly that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So Google Chrome facilitates that
because they
facilitate third-party cross-site cookies, user tracking, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I could actually do, there are companies out there harvesting that information to track what your employees are doing. And I think if you're using Chrome as your internal in-house standard, you might want to start reconsidering that and look at Firefox or Safari according to your personal preference.
All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. They help organizations deliver business critical services by providing performance visibility and actionable intelligence from every user over any network to every app, including Office 365 and Salesforce. They have cloud agents, enterprise agents, and endpoint agents that give them unique insights on network behavior, topologies, and how they affect app performance. They've also got intuitive visualizations to break down complex performance issues across networks that you own, and more importantly, those that you don't. And that can help reduce your troubleshooting time and pinpoint root causes. You can generate performance data through active monitoring techniques. You can correlate multiple layers of performance data from layer 7 to layer 3. You can pinpoint the root causes of device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, DDoS attacks, and more. You can share these event dashboards, metrics, and visualizations with vendors and customers. You can work together to resolve the problems faster. Here's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. Sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. That's thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. While you're there, grab yourself a free t-shirt. Thousand Eyes, thrive in a connected world. Back to the news. Infoblox, they've launched a new cloud-based DNS, DHCP, and IPAM service for branch and remote offices. The idea is here you install a lightweight software package at each branch. It can run on a VM or a container, and then instead of backhauling your DNS request to HQ, the request will hit the cloud service instead. And the idea is to ensure that the DNS name resolution happens locally, especially for things like SaaS applications. So you want that SaaS request at the branch to go to the nearest Office 365 POP instead of the one closest to the headquarters where you did that DNS resolution.
This is an attempt to try and bypass the Windows DNS. Mm-hmm. So you want to be able to have your, and Infoblox has been doing this for a number of years and providing a range of value-added services around it. But if you're doing breakout at the branch, you don't want to be doing forward lookups down to your data center to go blah, blah, blah. So this idea is that they can run a little NFV type instance, so container on a router, container on your SD-WAN appliance, and then have Infoblox managing all of your DNS and DHCP and IP address management consistently across the network.
Yep. Yeah, they also say because it's a cloud platform, you get visibility into your IP address space for all your branch and remote offices, which could come in handy.
No mention of what managing IP addresses in your public cloud, though. Did they talk about that at all?
They did not, no.
So they're sort of not really where we want to be. If I was, I'd want to be managing the IP addresses in my public cloud as well. Maybe it does that, and I don't know.
No, I don't think so. I think this is very much focused on the branch and remote office at this point. They've built this cloud-based platform that they're extending into various use cases, so that may be on a roadmap, but that's not where they're going with this release. This is focused on branch and remote office.
Okay, so all they've done is repackaged the DNS server into a container or a standalone VM so that you can do a software deployment of it at the edge of your network and then develop a cloud platform. I guess better late than never, I suppose.
Sure. Right? Exactly.
Baby steps. Not really, you know, good work, I guess. Yeah, that should have been predictable. Probably should have been doing it 2 years ago, but sure. Okay.
Well, here they are. Yes.
Here they are. That's right.
All right. And we have a link in the show notes if you want to see the press release. It's Cisco security advisory time. The latest list includes 6 critical advisories and 15 high alerts. Platforms with critical advisories include Cisco UCS Director and UCS Director Express and the Small Biz 220 Series Smart Switch.
Yeah, the usual list of Cisco comedy bugs, best I can describe it. Authentication bypasses, default credentials, boot hardware tamper, like a whole long range of things. Cisco does have a regular monthly cycle, although it's just possible looking at reading some of these bugs that Cisco's internal business units might actually be doing some security testing. These don't look to me like they were discovered externally or via a bug bounty program. They actually might have come from some internal stuff and Cisco's just making them public. And if that's true, then good, because it's about time we saw Cisco taking security more, at least some of the business units might actually be taking security more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a link to the list if you need to go check it.
Yes, if you do, you should if you haven't, because there's some schoolboy errors in there.
So I know we talked about VMware earlier. I just wanted to touch on a couple of interesting results from their Q2 2020 quarterly earnings. The top line results, quarterly revenues of $2.4 billion. But this jumped out at me. VMware's net income for the quarter is actually twice its quarterly revenues because the company got a $4.9 billion tax break What is the tax break for? The press release says it resulted from, quote, an internal transfer of international intellectual property rights. And I'm assuming that this is related to a tax break for repatriating IP to the United States, which was part of Congress's 2017 tax cut. I also wonder, knowing that they were going to get a $4.9 billion tax break instead of returning to shareholders, they were like, hey, let's go on a buying spree.
Well, the money comes from somewhere. Like Cisco is still sitting on, I think it's like $30 billion, even though it's repatriated many tens of billions of dollars. I think it's still sitting on $30 billion. It's got lots of money left to keep buying companies or to return to shareholders or to do buybacks. And yep. It seems to be holding back on what it's going to do. It's not rushing into making any decisions there, which I think is interesting. In your point of view, I think what you're trying to say is that the tax break of $4.9 billion almost paid for the acquisition of Pivotal and Carbon Black.
And look at the acquisitions they've made. It's Avi Networks, Bitfusion, Veriflow, Pivotal, Carbon Black, and now Uhana. And that's a lot for VMware to be doing essentially all in one quarter. So I'm assuming this is connected.
Well, at least they're spending it, right? They're not doing nothing and staying still, which is
right. You know, right? It's smart.
It's very easy to be critical of the companies and say, you know, if they're not moving, then you just sit there and say they're being boring, like. Cisco needs to do something like this. Cisco needs to go out and make a move into a new space instead of buying a little bit of this and a feature here and a team of people here to start a new product feature. You know, I think Cisco needs to sort of, you know, and the same for HPE. HPE just got a $660 million lawsuit, but announced it wouldn't be returning the money to shareholders or wouldn't affect its dividend. In theory, these companies should be out buying people and making newer, greater products for us instead of sitting on it. So they don't all work. Something like more than half of all acquisitions fail completely. So don't have high expectations here. Most of these companies do failure as the default mode. So we'll just see how it goes. Don't rush into any of these things is the advice as always.
But it's an interesting mix of companies that VMware picked up. Somebody like Veriflow, I know you guys already talked about it, doing that data center modeling is interesting. Carbon Black puts them squarely in the security space. I think they've spent this money wisely instead of just either kicking it upstairs for some nice fat executive bonuses or returning it to shareholders. I think they're positioning themselves to keep accelerating. People have talked about what's going to happen to VMware in a cloud first world. We see VMware cobbling together a pretty good answer.
So far, they've had plenty of failures, like a bunch of acquisitions that have never really gone anywhere, but that's okay. That's just normal, you know. But so, yep, you know, if you think you're going to rush out and buy you some Carbon Black, maybe just take a breath, you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And speaking about bets that don't always pay off, I looked at Carbon Black's publicly traded. I looked at their last quarterly earnings before the acquisition. They're predicting losses of up to $45 million for their fiscal year 2019. They had losses for the last quarter where VMware picked them up, and their quarterly revenues are just over $500 million. So it's not, they've got growth, but it's not a huge money-making engine considering the amount VMware paid out for them.
Yeah. Well, they've got the growth because they've been trying to grow to the point. Now they've been sold out to VMware. Now they've cashed out. VMware will no doubt turn it into a profit by doubling the price.
That could happen. It's entirely possible.
Yeah, and then they'll get a whole bunch of sales, pull-through sales, yeah.
Sure.
Just, you know, give another product to the sales reps and give them an excuse to go out and knock on doors of the customers again. So, yeah.
All right, moving on. Back in December, we reported on a CenturyLink outage that disrupted services across the U.S., including 911 calls, and lasted for 37 hours. Now the Federal Communications Commission has issued a comprehensive analysis of the outage that details the cause and CenturyLink's response. I looked through the white paper. It's pretty instructive.
The outage was caused by an equipment failure, catastrophically exacerbated by a network configuration error. I thought that was rather splendid. I didn't really get a lot of time to get inside of this other than to briefly read over the ARS Technica post on this one. Mm. And basically some malformed packets seemed to have caused a failure in the routers, which was then the operators seemed to have doubled down on it and made it much worse than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, so it was just four malformed management packets. They were set in broadcast mode. They had no expiration set. So essentially, they just proliferated through the network, caused a loop, ate up processing power, so the routers couldn't forward any traffic, and everything started to fail. The CenturyLink operators still don't know how those packets were generated. And it turns out that So Infinera were the nodes that caused the outage. They had this management channel that produced these packets enabled by default. CenturyLink knew the channel was operating, but had never configured or used it. So I guess that's the misconfiguration issue.
Sounds like a faulty NIC broadcasting all ones in the MAC address frame, which is pretty common. Something that's happened to me a few times over the last 30 years. And they really should. So there's a management network inside their network that they weren't taking control of. You're not going to get away with that one. Yeah, they're critical infrastructure. You can't just treat that like amateur hour. That is not. Yeah.
Right. And I think the reason the FCC got involved is because 911 calls were affected, which affects public emergency services. So serious business.
Yeah, 911 was the big one. Although they. The report, actually, I got as far into the report, which said that 911 call delivery missed 800 calls, none of which were life-threatening. So there is that for the...
That's good.
So there's the good news for today.
Yeah, that's right. and if you want to read the paper, we'll have a link to the whole white paper.
It's very readable.
It is very readable.
For an FCC document, it was competent. It certainly struck me as competent and readable.
Yeah,
I didn't get all the way through it, but I tried.
Yeah, no, take a look. It really is readable. So give it a look. All right, Google is proposing that SSL certs should expire after 397 days instead of the current expiration of 825 days, and this proposal is pitting browser developers against CAs.
Yeah, in particular here, there's a person who works for Google who sits on the certificate authorities, and he has a fairly aggressive attitude towards the way things should work, and quite often by simply recommending these things, they get done. But Let's Encrypt has proven that people are perfectly competent at rotating certificates every 3 months if that's what needs to be done, and you know we all run automation scripts that just go to Let's Encrypt and get a new one. Now, a lot of these certificate providers are quite annoyed because generating the certificates requires them to add another computer or two, and they'd much rather not bother. They'd rather do nothing and just make money for, you know, get money for jam. The original idea was that SSL certificates could be issued for up to, I think it was 10 years, and then it was brought down to 5, and then it was down to 3, and now the proposal is to take it down to 1 year. Once a certificate is out there, there's nothing to invalidate it. In practice. Now, in theory, there are certificate revocation lists maintained by the certificate authorities. But in practice, the certificate authorities do not maintain the certificate revocation list very well at all. And indeed, most browsers do not check the certificate revocation list because the infrastructure the certificate authorities built is so bad and so slow that you can't actually get to the websites in the time frame. If I issue a certificate with a 5-year expiry date, then I have to wait for and somebody compromises it, gets the private key or whatever. That certificate is legitimate for 5 more years until that time is up to 5 years. If CRLs were working, then in theory your browser would receive the certificate, then look up the CRL, the certificate revocation server, and get a yes, no. But nobody does that. The CAs made their bed and now they get to lie in it. They didn't do the work, the due diligence and the discipline to move them to a 1-year expiry. If anybody compromises your certificate, then the impact is limited to 1 year. And if you don't like that, then everybody's going to point at Let's Encrypt and go like, there's a success. Suck it up, pretty.
Yeah, and so many essential systems that people count on, you know, banking and finance and other sensitive information rely on the validity of certificates. And so I have no problem with having them be expiring faster and having fresh ones, new ones validated.
Sure. And there are some people who are going to have to, you know, get their big adult pants on and act like grown-ups and take control of this and learn how security works and not certificates work. And you know, I need to do more reading on certificate management and public key infrastructure. I'm very weak and I keep trying to get into a book and something always drags me away. But, you know, I don't have a problem with this per se because we've tried other things and failed. And this is the logical next step. And we've also proven that this is the next step.
Yeah, and this is critical infrastructure. At this point, certificates are critical infrastructure and they need to be treated as such.
In the old days, it was just like the only time that the certificate mattered was when you went to the shopping cart. Well,
we're way beyond that now.
That's right. Yes, indeed.
All right, well, that wraps up our news portion. Please stay tuned for our sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Big Switch. We're going to be talking about hybrid cloud networking and public and multi-cloud networking. That's happening right now. You're listening to Tech Bytes from the Packet Pushers, a 15-minute podcast that gives you a quick but comprehensive look at products and technologies in the real world. Our sponsor today is Big Switch, and we're going to discuss cloud networking, including hybrid and multi-cloud, with new products from Big Switch. Our guest is Paul Ubenhagen. He is CTO at Big Switch Networks. Paul, welcome to the show. Can you get us started with a quick intro of Big Switch Networks and what you guys are up to?
We're a cloud networking company. The best way to describe us is that we enable the Amazon AWS networking experience on-prem. So you're able to actually make a data center on-prem in your own environment operate in the same networking experience that your application team and DevOps teams have come to love out of the VPC experience in AWS. Built on SDNs, it's what makes everything in the cloud work.
I think the thing that I'd like to draw out about it is that Big Switch Networks is using SDN, but when, instead of trying to do overlays or underlays or hardware-defined networking or any of that sort of stuff, we're now talking about a Big Switch Networks that says this virtual private cloud networking that like they've been doing in AWS, that's a model that everybody seems to want. So can we bring that from the cloud into our data center? And can we have that sort of virtual networking without any connectivity to what's happening underneath? It's bringing that cloud-first networking approach right the way into your on-prem data center.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So if you think about it, AWS pretty much created the de facto user experience that every application developer wants in the world. And it points to just how mature SDN has become. It also points to the fact that, well, a lot of people don't realize it, SDN is everywhere. It's all around you, and you probably don't even realize it. And that's the reason why we leverage it to create that same experience on-prem. So it's a homogenous experience for application people.
And it grew out of it. Like Big Switch has been around for, you know, 7 or 8 years now, or longer, even 10.
Yeah.
And it's that been that SDN. But this is your flavor of SDN, and you're driving into the fact that everybody's going to be in the cloud. Is it really true that people look at the way AWS does VPCs and say that's the right way to do networking, and so much so that they want to put it on-prem?
All of our customers definitely do. In fact, our customers flat out say the reason why they chose us is because we provide the AWS networking experience on-prem. Every application team I know, that's why they use AWS, because it makes networking like a utility, like flipping a light switch. Anything they need shows up as they need it. Well, they can. One person coined the network dread. It's like sitting in rush hour traffic waiting for a VLAN to get configured.
Or how many MAC addresses, how many TCAM entries have I got left on my switch? Or,
exactly.
You know, how many VLAN IDs do I have left? Or how much BGP memory am I consuming? And so you're really bringing that sort of cloud separation where the networking itself doesn't depend on what's going on underneath, but you're still using SDN. And I get the whole package from Big Switch. You sell the switches and the software on the switch and the controller. You don't assemble it out of pieces. You bring the whole thing together.
Yeah, actually, so we're a software company, in fact, actually. So we believe in the white box model. So you can actually buy your switches from multiple vendors that support the ONI, and we install it just like the switch is a server. All right. Automatically, the software gets downloaded. In fact, we have interns that have deployed massive environments, Big Switch, where they were just sat there on an iPad and started plugging in the core links, and it just automatically appeared and automatically saw the VMware host, the Kubernetes environment. Everything just popped up automatically for them. The fabric saw it all just like a cloud should.
All right.
Okay, so that's the background on Big Switch, and your core product is Big Cloud Fabric. Now, my understanding is one of the announcements you're bringing out is that you're bringing Big Cloud Fabric to AWS. Can you tell us what that means?
So we've had a lot of customers experience the on-prem experience of AWS, but it creates a different experience when you've got to log into an on-prem environment, log into Azure, or log into AWS, and log into different places and try and see everything. It's created this big shadow IT problem in the industry that pretty much everybody knows about. We took the controller that we have, which actually grew out of the same lab that Google Cloud did, the Andromeda project, and we've enabled it to actually operate inside an AWS region so it can see across multiple accounts, all the VPCs, and give you a complete view modulously across all of those regions of what's going on. And so you can actually have the same experience in the same UI. So the productivity becomes the same and better.
The thing about Big Cloud Fabric in the cloud, in AWS and, you know, in the future, Azure and GCP, is that you're actually using their functions. You're not laying stuff over the top. You're not, that to me seems to be a differentiator. You're not trying to put routers in VMs or virtual switches or agents on the boxes. You're doing native.
Exactly. Native is actually the best way to do it, it turns out. Trying to duplicate or, you know, manipulate AWS and what they've done really, really well ends up creating an environment that's just not really good for what the actual team, networking teams or the application teams really want. Trying to take, and basically what you're doing when you do that is you're trying to take the old school 1990s campus data center style and force it into the cloud. And they don't really work well together. Mm-hmm. Our approach is, no, give better visibility of the existing infrastructure because they've done a great job and everyone knows what it is. In fact, the experience inside the BCF controller on-prem is actually that same native experience as well, VPCs too. We don't try and muck around or do overlays or force fit an old technique into a new style. It's kind of like buying a car and asking where, you know, the hay should be put in. because you're used to the horse and buggy.
Yeah.
So I'm running this big cloud fabric on AWS. It's an SDN controller. It's giving me a view into all the VPCs I've got running in AWS.
Yeah, you see across the, all the accounts and all the VPCs. You can see who created what VPCs. A lot of people don't know as well as we have a very large analytics engine as well. So you can actually get analytics about what's going on inside the environments too. As we grow this out, we're going to keep adding in more and more of the AWS services and exposure across all those accounts and all the VPCs.
So this means that an AWS, you know, that the DevOps team can be configuring away their AWS, and the BCF, the Big Cloud Fabric, will be able to pick up that configuration so that I can see it. Or I could be using BCF to pre-provision it.
Exactly. If you have a team that's very familiar with doing a controller-based thing on-prem and they want to be able to then take that same config and do it on, you know, up in AWS, they can use BCF, or vice versa. If they're used to AWS, they're going to be very comfortable with the BCF on-prem. So it creates a nice, you know, similar experience versus, you know, it's the old days when we used to be in routers and to be two different CLIs and scratch your head.
So this is really multi-cloud. So this, obviously, if you've got a controller on-prem managing the Big Cloud Fabric with the virtual private cloud networking model, and you've got the same thing happening up in AWS or Azure, you want to join those together, right? So this is where Multi-Cloud Director comes in?
Exactly. So MCD basically allows you to have that visibility across all the BCF deployments, which we call pods. We have several customers out there who run numerous BCF pods, and this allows them to see across them. So in fact, one customer right now is using MCD, and they see close to around 40 different pods into one screen that they can manage across the entire environment, no matter where they're located geographically too.
So how does the Multi-Cloud Director come together? Like, if you've got the two data centers and they're talking together, you're unifying them as one thing.
So MCD, what it does is it sees each of the pods individually and collects it into a cohesive view across all of the deployments. It basically is a manager over top of all that. So if you want to make changes and see the entire global deployment, you can go directly to MCD and drive down the changes you want. And as well control, because we also have a monitoring fabric that allows that. So we see all those type of controllers, whether you're doing the analytics fabric or the configuration fabric, and get to see all at once. It's not actually moving packets. It's not in the data plane. It's simply driving down the configuration in a common, similar way so that your UI is simple. And it goes really as an API-driven function. Everything we do is API-driven because we really believe in infrastructure as a code and API functionality.
So if MCD goes down, you're saying that the controllers, the individual controllers for your VPCs will still keep running?
Yeah. All right. So within every single pod, there's a redundant set of controllers that are simply driving configuration down to the switches. They're not involved in moving packets at all. It would be a very ridiculous way to build out your network, right? They're just driving down the individual configurations because in an SDN and an API perspective, right, it's got a view of where everything needs to be, and it's seeing where the VMs are and knows to drive down the right policies to the right switch. All the routing decisions, all the switching decisions, all the policy decisions are actually done right on the individual leaf switch. So it knows where the packet's coming from, the leaf switch that is, and it knows exactly where it's going to go, and it routes it directly to that class architecture.
So you're not in the control plane. The data plane is in the node. And same for the cloud. Once you configure the function in the public cloud, that function is set. The big, whether BCF is there or not doesn't matter if it drops off for 15 minutes or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And to your point earlier about that's why we're using the native functions, right? We're just collecting what's been configured and allowing you to configure more through BCF. So someone, you know, if you have an application developer, for example, that uses Terraform to drive a new configuration, it's automatically going to show up in AWS, and it's automatically going to show up in the BCF controller in the cloud. It's going to see that and be able to, if you have a DevOps guy who needs to make a slight change to that or collect a Terraform config out of it, he can do that all directly there because it's seeing the status and driving the status versus actually being involved in the packet moving. Because that's why you do native functions. It performs better.
Got it. Okay, so then looking out at the future, you've also been talking about a global VPC option.
Yeah, global VPCs, and Google has a form in this as well. And we do agree that the idea is really important as for look at the future of where things are going. And from our perspective, we like the global VPC concept because it allows two forms. One, let's say you want to do a migration from one location to another. Right? Global VPC will allow you to actually extend the segments between them and natively see it as one big VPC. Or the flip of that is, say you want to actually drive template concepts that you have a set of VPCs in the cloud and you want to move an application on-prem or vice versa, you know, move on-prem to the cloud. You could say, you know, mimic this VPC over here, because you have a global configuration of a VPC that you can drive down to multiple locations.
So that means you've got a unified view at the same type of networking happening on the on-prem, in the off, and in any of the other clouds. Like AWS might walk around saying there's only one true cloud, and that's them, of course. But the real answer is there's multiple cloud vendors, and you're going to be in a hybrid cloud environment where you have multiple cloud providers. But you want to have a unified networking construct so that you can see what's going on in all of them, and this is one way to do that.
I think the on-prem too is pretty important as well as we look at the future of networking and data centers for applications, because I think all too often we tend to get trapped in this idea that the cloud is somewhere else. And we lose focus on the fact that application developers need that same experience on-prem. Mm. And that's where the global VPC and the VPC in general comes into play, is that it gives that on-prem should be part of your cloud. You need to look at them all together as one cloud.
I've got a selfish view here. I think if I was an engineer working on a customer, I want to get some career skills around the clouds. If I was working in the sort of SDN, you know, the multi-cloud SDN, which sort of lays this proprietary tool over the top and hides the cloud underneath away from you, you're not getting those skills in AWS or Azure. Whereas I like the way Big Switch is doing it. I could start by getting my cloud looking like my on-prem, but at the same time, I can be buffing up and learning about the cloud that's underneath and putting that onto my resume. I think there's a personal angle here for some people who are listening here who are thinking about how do I learn about the cloud while keeping things going? And I think that might be a motivator for some people.
That is very true. We have a lot of customers that definitely came from that perspective as well. And then they've gained the benefit of, now that they understand the cloud in a deeper level, they're more involved in a lot of the application development and planning for the future, whether or not it's in AWS or it's on-prem, because now they understand it at a level that they're able to provide guidance and, you know, consulting to the application teams in a way they couldn't before.
Yeah, I guess you'd be speaking the DevOps language, you know, the developer's language. You'd be talking about APIs and VPCs and, you know, the sorts of constructs that a lot of these developers who come from other places into your organization. And you're saying, sure, we can do the VPCs and we can give you the same AWS APIs on-prem almost, and the same networking construct. So why don't you just use those? That takes away a lot of the trauma of, big inverted commas here, digital transformation, this cloudification of your apps. Right? And I think that's important.
Exactly.
And I mean, that's why you're doing Terraform, because Terraform is the tool that most people use for multi-cloud. Like if you're on a cloud, like if you're in AWS, you use AWS CLI and their own tools. But if you're doing multiple cloud provisioning, you're using Terraform because it's the one from that is able to work with Azure and GCP and AWS. And Terraform is a better tool than the others from that point of view.
We chose Terraform because we have a lot of customers actually using Terraform on a daily basis. Infrastructure as a code is here, and it's here to stay for very good reasons. It makes deploying applications incredibly easy for those teams, right? So if you're someone who doesn't like Terraform and you want something else, we're actually looking at other, you know, projects as well. But we went based on the fact that we had a lot of customers asking for their ability. So now when you're sitting there as an application developer building out your Terraform file, you can actually see the Big Cloud Fabric, the fabric itself, that whole pod, just like you see AWS's VPCs or Azure's VNets, and drive the configuration via Terraform file, just the same way.
And then the Big Cloud Fabric reads that configuration back, assembles it so that you can see what's going on, and away you go.
Yep, automatically deploys the VPC on-prem, just like the AWS automatically deploys the VPC in the cloud.
Well, that about wraps it up for the time we have for this TechBytes. Paul, I'm sure you've piqued some people's interest. If they want to find out more, where would they go?
So there's two places actually really easy for you to try this out without ever having to talk to anybody at Big Switch if you don't want to, or just to, the BCF in AWS is actually a freemium. You can find it right on now on AWS Marketplace and try it for free. We do have an enterprise model that opens up even, you know, bigger scale, but if you want to try it out, go there. And if you want to try out what it'd be like in a large environment, you can actually go to labs.bigswitch.com and you can actually, you know, drive a simulated environment through the controller of what it's like to have an actual VPC on-prem like experience too that way.
Okay, so there's that address. You can also go to Amazon Marketplace or AWS Marketplace and look for Big Cloud Fabric. And we'll have all these links in the show notes that accompany this podcast if you want to find out more. But that does wrap up this Tech Byte. Thank you, Paul and Big Switch, for being sponsors. You can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much cloud would never be enough.